Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. And welcome to New Books Network. My name is Geert, your host for today, and with us is Dr. Matthias Leese. He's a senior researcher for governance and technology at the Center for Security Studies, if I'm saying this correctly, at the ETH Institute in Zurich. Welcome, Matthias.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great that you came, that we found the time. So we will be discussing the book that he wrote together with his colleague, Dr. Simon Eckbert from the Technische Universität in Berlin, called Criminal Futures, Predictive Policing and Everyday Police Work, which is published in the Routledge Studies in Policing and Society series just this year. Before we dive into the book, Matthias, could you maybe tell us a bit more about who you are, professionally speaking, and what your broader research usually looks like?
Yes, absolutely. So my disciplinary background is actually international relations. But back in the day when I was doing my master's, I was working as a student assistant in the, what was it called actually, Institute for Prevention and Security Research. At the University of Hamburg. And so this is where I first got in touch with criminological research. So we had a project back then, which was engaging societal attitudes towards surveillance and control technologies in Germany. And I was quite fascinated by that whole thematic around, you know, technology, policing, security. And so I went on to Tübingen. I pursued my PhD in international relations, but the topic stayed with me, and so did my kind of curiosity in criminology. And now, you know, several years later, I took the opportunity to do this research project together with Simon, because I was always fascinated about the impact of technology on security organizations. All right. So more broadly speaking, I look into data matters in law enforcement and border control. But in this particular project, we really applied a criminological lens, so to say, to study how, you know, traditional police work, like, you know, internal security, is being transformed through the introduction of new technologies.
Yeah, makes sense. And what made you then decide to actually start up this project, like now, now in the past couple of years?
Yeah, I suppose, like, you know, most research projects, it was more or less pure coincidence. I just had started my job here at ETH Zurich as a senior researcher when there was the first kind of, you know, media attention being drawn to predictive policing in the German-speaking world. And so it turned out that the Zurich Municipal Police Department had just started a trial run with Precops, which is a commercial software package built by a German company. And so I picked up the phone. I asked them, you know, what they were doing and whether it would be possible to have a look and, you know, speak with some people. And they were surprisingly open and they told me to just come by. I looked at Google Maps and it turns out that their headquarters is just, you know, a couple hundred meters down the street. And that was that.
That's excellent. And your collaboration with Dr. Eckert?
Yeah, we actually... So based on that first encounter with the Zurich Municipal Police, I designed a research project, an empirical project for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, however long it would take to get a really good understanding, a really good grasp of what's happening in the field. And so I took that research design to a workshop in Germany, and there I met Simon for the first time. We didn't know each other before. And it turned out that he had also just started a research project on predictive policing in Germany. And my design and his design were quite similar. And so it turns out we had been reading the same literature, we kind of had the same questions in mind. And yeah, so we decided to join forces. And so instead of one project looking at Germany and one project looking at Switzerland, we had a bigger project that looked at Germany and Switzerland, which made a lot of sense because, as I said before, at the time, there was one commercial software package available that was used in both Switzerland and Germany. So I think it gave us a pretty good, it was not a formally comparative perspective, but we could actually see the different practices in different police departments, not along the lines of different national backgrounds, but more in terms of, how different organizations dealt with technological change. And so I think overall, this gave us a really good perspective on how predictive policing technology has impacted very concrete practices of crime prevention, but how it has also impacted larger trajectories of change in police departments as they now try to get ready for the future, try to overhaul their technical infrastructures, their means of data analysis, they try to build up expertise and so on. So I think overall, this has been a really fascinating research project, and I'm actually quite happy with the book.
Understandable. Maybe, in terms of methodology, what did you do, and maybe also what was the how did you divide tasks with your colleague?
Yeah. So overall, we pursued a qualitative approach. Which means that our prime intention was to go into the field and to kind of really retrace the perspective and the experiences of those people involved. And so methodologically speaking, we combined three different methods. So first and foremost, we interviewed people. I think in the end, we ended up with more than 60 interviews with people from the police, but also from private companies, tech suppliers, on all strategic and operational levels. And then we complemented these interviews with ethnographic observations, which means that we visited police stations, we were allowed to kind of, spend the day or a couple of hours with the people operating the software, doing the predictions, crafting the memos, and so on. And these ethnographic observations formed the second empirical data part. And the third data part was then document analysis. So we collected more than, I think, 300 documents, publicly available documents, but also police internal documents. And so combining these different methods and these different types of data, I feel really gave us a good overall, perspective on what was happening. So we kind of triangulated in a sense to really see what the essence was, if you want to put it that way.
Did you also get to join any patrols?
Unfortunately not, but we were able to speak with a lot of patrol forces to really also incorporate their perspective on the whole change, basically.
Could you maybe give us a bit of, because you also have you also sketched the development of predictive policing as such. Could you maybe give us a bit of historical background of current predictive policing, and maybe also how is predictive policing, as you understand it, different from the other deterrence-oriented methods like hotspot policing or community-oriented policing or so?
Yeah, so first of all, I think we need to make a a basic distinction. So predictive policing can mean a lot of things, but essentially, I think it can mean two main different things. The first variant of predictive policing is geared towards people. This is something that we see in the US, in the UK partly, but also in other parts of the world. And this is an approach that tries to identify people who might, you know, become criminals in the future, or who might be likely victims of crime in the future, and then to intervene with those people on an individual basis. So in other words, this might be described as risk profiling. This is something that is not done in Europe, at least not on a broad scale. But the kind of predictive policing that we find in Europe is a variant that targets space and time. So basically, it starts from the assumption that certain types of crime follow patterns in time and space. And these patterns can be identified through the analysis of data. And so from the analysis of past distributions of crime in time and space, there can be a prediction generated. So basically, you take the past and you try to extrapolate it into the future in more or less dynamic forms. And you try to identify certain spaces, certain, you know, neighborhoods, streets that might be prone to higher crime levels in a certain time frame, say 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours. And then you try to come up with interventions, so basically crime prevention measures. In our case, the PreCop software primarily targets burglary, residential burglary, which is a phenomenon that I would say is actually quite primed for such an approach, because it happens at scale. That means there is a lot of data available. There is also a lot of research available. So we do have established criminological knowledge, primarily in the form of near-repeat offense theory, or near-repeat victimization theory, that basically says if there's a burglary within a certain area, then it's actually quite likely that there's going to be follow-up burglaries close by in the same area. So there's a certain, you know, repetition pattern in residential burglary. And this can, of course, be operationalized and used to intervene into those patterns as they unfold, right? So the aim of the police here is to create a deterrence by, you know, sending out more patrols, sending out these patrols in a more targeted fashion to, you know, show their presence and to, you know, signal to potential criminals that the risk of being caught and arrested would be far too high. So the idea is, of course, that criminals do act in a, you know, certain rationalized way. They kind of make a bargain, and they kind of weigh in the risk and the rewards. And if the risk gets too high, then they opt not to commit any offenses. I mean, it's pretty simple, actually. And so I think when we look at predictive policing from the intervention perspective, then it's, and I mean, that there's actually an academic debate about that, whether it can be clearly distinguished from approaches such as intelligence-led policing. Some people say, you know, there's not a clear distinction. And I think actually what we retrace in the book is that there's quite a lot of continuity when it comes to situational crime prevention, right? So the approach, you know, goes back to the 1970s, 1980s, and it has always incorporated the identification of, you know, certain areas that might be more susceptible to crime. And then, you know, there's environmental crime prevention, where you kind of target the environmental factors such as lighting or such as, you know, spots that could be easily used by criminals for robbery, for pickpocketing. So in that sense, we see a growth of surveillance cameras. We see a kind of a remodeling of many urban areas to kind of reduce the crime risk. And in a sense, of course, predictive policing does follow a similar strategy. You know, it doesn't target the built environment, but it does target the environment by creating more visibility and creating more deterrences. But it does so in a more flexibilized way, right? So you send in police patrols, you run awareness campaigns in the neighborhood, run traffic controls at, critical junctions, public transport, and so on. So you have very targeted interventions that try to reduce the crime risk in a certain neighborhood, a certain area, for a specific time frame. So I think, as I said, there is a quite long lineage actually here. Situational crime prevention theory, as I said, is a quite well-established criminological theory. And what predictive policing does, I think, for the first time, is to scale up these ideas. Right. So based on the idea that nowadays we have enough data available and we have the technological means to analyze these data in automated ways that speed up things. The idea here is that, you take established ideas, you take established strategies, and you speed them up. And you make them, you scale them up and you speed them up, making them more applicable and, allegedly more easily to integrate into policing practices. And this is, of course, where we kind of step in with a book and we say, look, it is not that easy.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe describe this this socio-technical complex or the socio-technical system. Why is this such an important concept for you?
Yeah, it is an important concept, or it is the key concept in the book, actually, because I think it gives us, from a social science perspective, a lot of, new possibilities in terms of how to conduct our research. Because, and I think I got to step back a little here and start by saying that, a lot of social science research when it comes to technology tends to incorporate a certain, technological determinism, right? So technology is understood as something that, kind of comes in from the outside and it has a kind of a force on its own and, it does things, and it is kind of assumed that, technology does what it's supposed to do. But science and technology studies actually, going back to the late 1980s or so, have demonstrated time and again that this is not the case, right? So, and we also know kind of similar things from organizational sociology, for instance. So, looking at organizations and how they incorporate new technologies is always likely to create friction, right? So from an organizational perspective, any kind of change is likely to be met with resistance. It is kind of likely that people reappropriate technologies in their everyday practice. So they use them in unforeseen ways, creating kind of unintended consequences and so on. And so this brings me to this idea of socio-technical systems, where you step away from the idea that technology could be dealt with in an isolated fashion, but rather you put it into larger social and organizational contexts. And you look at the relations that the technology forms with different parts of its environment. And I think this is particularly pertinent when it comes to complex organizations such as police departments, right, where you have a high level of functional differentiation, lots of, you know, specialized knowledge and specialized expertise that is distributed among different units, and these units need to work together and communicate in order to make things work. And so looking at predictive policing from a socio-technical perspective kind of brings that to the foreground, right? It really shows us that, or it puts the analytical emphasis on how different people and different organizational units deal with technology in different ways, and how, in order to produce the intended effect, their work needs to become aligned. And this puts a lot of emphasis on translation, right? So translation is the second key concept that we use in the book. So basically, translation, as developed by Bruno Latour and others, means the alignment of, you know, different knowledges and different communication practices within an organization, with the aim of, you know, making things and people work together to produce the intended outcome. And so the assumption here is that knowledge and power can only be created and transmitted within an organization if translation processes are in place between different units and different people. And so in our case, the translation circle actually starts with the production of data in the field, you know, where a police patrol is called to a crime scene and they file a report, and that report then goes into the database, and that forms the foundation for crime analysis, right? And then you have the analyst who works with the software, creating very detailed situational insights, kind of very specific time frames, very specific levels of risk, very specific spatial parameters, et cetera, et cetera. And this knowledge then, again, needs to be translated into something that is tangible for the people who do the resource management, right? Who assign patrols, who make sure that there's patrol cars available, who make sure that, you know, shift schedules don't conflict with other things. And then again, it needs to be translated to the people who do the actual, you know, crime prevention work on the street level, the patrol officers. And so there's a lot of steps involved here that really, I think, can help us to understand how a socio-technical perspective on predictive policing can help us understand why it is so complex and why it is, you know, not as easy and straightforward as you know, media discourses and you know, technology companies and policymakers sometimes suggest to us.
Yeah. Do you maybe have did you, during your research, did you run into a good example of how a technology or a tool such as Precops or perhaps some other step from the process has been used in an unforeseen way by the human actors, maybe?
Yeah, I think one of the very, not particularly surprising things, but one of the very pertinent things that we came across is what we deal with in chapter 5, which is called Humans and Machines. And this chapter 5 really details some of the, you know, conflict situations that we have witnessed between humans and the system in air quotes. So that they tend to be, you know, okay, again, I think I need to do a little step back. So, when it comes to the interactions between humans and machines, I mean, we actually know from engineering and design studies that, you know, different levels of automation require different ways of interaction between humans and systems. And so for a long time, there was this assumption that, you know, the more you automate processes, the better this will be because, you know, it frees up resources for humans to do other things and so on. But there has been a bit of backlash more recently where people have kind of come to the insight that more automation is not always a good thing, right? Automation is often kind of synonymous with black boxing, right? And if you have, you know, complex analytical processes that you just completely delegate to an algorithm in a closed system, then this black box will not be easily understandable, and it will not be easy to kind of retrace what's happening for the human user. And we have really seen these kind of conflicts around the construction of knowledge between, you know, highly automated machine processes on the one hand, and the need for human control on the other hand, in predictive policing. So, I mean, obviously, you know, we're speaking about law enforcement here, we're speaking about security, we're speaking about a very sensitive and very kind of, you know, sometimes even delicate task that the police do. And so I think from an organizational self-understanding, most police departments do want to stay in charge, right? They want to know what's happening. They want to know on, you know, what basis they are doing crime prevention. And they really want to be able to also kind of challenge the machine. So we see often here a conflict between professional expertise and also experience on the one hand, you know, police officers saying, look, we've been doing crime prevention for 20, 30 years. You know, this is my city. This is my neighborhood. I know where the hotspots are. And then on the other hand, you have this kind of, you know, rationalization process where now the idea is that through data, you get more accurate forecasts. You can act in a more flexible and dynamic fashion. And so this creates kind of a tension around the question of authority. So who should be the one, you know, who gets to say where to go and what to do? Is it data? Is it the algorithm? Is it the analyst working with the software? Is it the patrol officer who has to enact these things on the street? And then, of course, again, we have another conflict that is more of a normative one, I think. When I said police departments want to stay in charge of what they're doing, they always implement, at least in our cases, they always implemented predictive policing software in a fashion where the human would ultimately have to double check for plausibility and release the alert before it was enacted. And this kind of created very interesting constellations about reasoning. Right. And again, you know, if the human user can't really understand how the system came to a certain conclusion, then this makes it quite difficult to challenge the system and to override it and to say, no, this is, you know, this is actually bullshit. You know, this is you know, not something that we want to do, because we know this is maybe an industrial area, or, you know, this is an abandoned house or whatever. So logically, you know, going there makes no sense. But to challenge machine recommendations is actually quite tough, because, you know, they come with this aura of neutrality and of rationalization, and the police officers we spoke with often lack the vocabulary to really, you know, kind of get into an argument with the machine. And so their challenges were often based on, you know, what they called gut feelings. So it was a more intangible sense of experience that they would relate to. And I think these are some of the frictions and some of the, you know, unforeseen things that really can happen if you implement a technology into an organization that has been doing things in a certain way for a long time. And then, you know, technology comes in, and technology is bound to change these ways. And again, I think we know from criminological research in the past that, you know, especially in kind of conservative organizations such as police organizations, there is a tendency to resist change and to kind of, you know, argue with the machine in that sense, and to override the machine. But again, I think it just brought to the surface very, very interesting new constellations about how humans and, in this case, a software, enter into a socio-technical relation that produces peculiar effects sometimes.
It's interesting that you bring this up, because you suggest that that predictive policing is, well, as exciting and as sensational a job as is traditional policing, so to say. But what you just described, it does seem to suggest that the job of a policeman will definitely be changing if there's more of a predictive element into it. Also because in like an ideal case where there's a lot of deterrence and very little like crime scenes, so to say. I mean, the most extreme case would be that no officer ever encounters a criminal or a kilo of cocaine or a gun. Will a future police force, will that like exist of a few passive observers in the street maybe, and like a horde of analysts in the office, or would that be an exaggeration?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to say where exactly we are heading, but this kind of prevention paradox that you mentioned, that does play a huge role, right? And it first and foremost, it plays a role in the question of, you know, whether the software actually works, you know, whether it does its job. I mean, we have been in a global pandemic for almost 2 years, and I think by now we know a thing or two about the prevention paradox. But it's in the specific case of predictive policing, it's kind of tough to measure at the end of the day, you know, whether a crime has been prevented or not, because it is not a controlled laboratory environment, but it's a complex and messy world outside there. And so the police literally have no idea whether a crime was actually bound to happen, or, you know, whether or not, for a gazillion reasons, possibly. And so, yeah, it's kind of a key question also with regard to, you know, politics and the media and the general public as to, you know, how or whether predictive policing can be framed as a success. And of course, you know, you also have to see that considerable resources go into predictive policing, money-wise, time-wise, etc. So I think one interesting thing that we have seen in evaluation reports is that, you know, some police departments have pursued a quite, you know, I would say, straightforward approach to evaluating predictive policing, trying to argue with the numbers, kind of, you know, comparing residential burglary stats from before they were using the software and after they were using the software. But then again, you know, these kinds of, you know, numbers games, they are epistemically speaking a bit shaky. And now the interesting thing is that other departments have chosen not to engage in the numbers games at all, and rather to go for more process-based evaluations. And again, I think, you know, we need to keep in mind that police organizations are not, you know, flexible tech startups that can easily, you know, be managed in flexible ways. But, you know, they are public organizations, which comes with a bit of, you know, kind of a built-in slowness and inflexibility. And a lot of their digital infrastructure actually, you know, goes back to the late 90s and early 2000s, when we had the first, you know, digitization wave in public administration and security organizations. And so, speaking of process-based evaluations, they were trying to make sure that, you know, predictive policing was actually working. And so the success criteria for them were much more low level and almost banal, as, for example, in does our database structure actually support the transmission, the quick transmission and analysis of data. Can we actually, you know, effectively communicate between different divisions and different departments? Do we have the resources and the practical flexibility to actually bring crime forecasts to the street? So these were criteria that some of the police departments used in order to measure the success, in air quotes, of predictive policing. And I think this is one of the most interesting takeaways long-term from the study, is that these evaluations were used in order to justify what I would call larger digital transformation processes in the police. Right, so I think predictive policing gave them a very good argument, you know, to go up to the command branch and say, look, we need money, because obviously, you know, the future is going to be digital. There's more and more data, the data that we produce ourselves, the data that we get from other sources, and now we need the infrastructures and also the expertise and in terms of manpower to deal with these challenges. And I think if predictive policing has shown one thing, then this was that there's quite a lot of frictions and, you know, quite a lot of stuff that didn't work right from the start. And this also, you know, draws, of course, attention to more high-level problems. Both Switzerland and Germany are federal states, where, you know, on the state level, there's a lot of competence and a lot of you know, sovereignty when it comes to security, and so and this drew attention to cross state data exchange, and you know,
large on a regional level.
Yeah, exactly. So particularly here in Switzerland, I remember we had organized a workshop with. Representatives from different cantonal police departments. Some of them had already been using predictive policing software and some of them had not. And the ones that had been using software were like, okay, you know, we have a crime hotspot that kind of transcends cantonal boundaries, but our data only reach to the border, right? And so we would need additional data that, you know, gives us the full situational picture and, you know, really put us in a position to make sensible forecasts. But we don't have the data from the other cantonal police force. And the current legal situation does not allow for automated data exchange. So I think a lot of these, you know, deeply ingrained old problems have come to be re-problematized through predictive policing. And so I think it has been, in a way, used as a wake-up call, I would say, both towards policymakers, but also towards the command branch, that, you know, that there is a need to reform police organizations to really kind of seize the opportunities that, you know, digital data and algorithms provide to them.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The data and the algorithm, they're not in a vacuum. They are like inside an organization, inside a region, inside a big political system, and they all interact. It's peculiar. You say that I think that's in the introduction somewhere, that things are not as big data, so to say, as you might expect. How did you mean that?
Yeah, so I think the idea of big data that's, you know, floating around I think in everybody's head is that you know, the world consists of data, and, you know, we can get data from all kinds of different sources and, you know, kind of draw them together, and through advanced analytics we can then create, you know, super advanced insights. Because we can then all of a sudden recognize patterns that, you know, go beyond our human understanding. But at least in our case, what we studied, predictive policing was rather small data, right? So the data that the police used for analysis were, in most of the cases, the data that they produced themselves from crime scenes, right? And so there's actually quite a limited number of data categories, such as the street address, so location, GPS data, the type of offense, the stolen goods, the modus operandi, so the ways in which burglars got access to an apartment or to a house, and a few other things as well. And I think one of the, at least, you know, kind of discursively what is presented as an advantage with the pre-cup system was that there's only a very limited number of data points that you need to create a sensible forecast. And so in that sense, it is very, very small data. But, you know, we should not confuse small data with, you know, no problems data. There's actually a lot of problems also in police data. And the police departments that we studied have tried to implement a lot of quality control measures in order to really make sure that their data also give them, you know, a good analysis and good forecasts. And I think there's, in terms of data quality, there's of course lots of different challenges. So first of all, you know, it is a domain where limited knowledge is kind of the rule. So I mean, obviously, you don't know everything right from the beginning, and you know, as investigations go on, there usually tends to be more data, more information, and so data in the system needs to be updated. But this can take time, right? This can actually take a couple of days or a week or so before the data gets updated. And this creates a conflict with the idea of near-repeat victimization theory, because there you would assume that, you know, the kind of follow-up offenses that occur, they occur in a very short time frame. So anything between 48 and 72 hours is a sensible time frame to act upon. But of course, you know, if you only get accurate data after a week or so, then this is already too late. And if you go on to analyze data that is a week old, this gives you situational insights that, you know, cannot be enacted anymore.
Yeah, this this really made me, especially your chapter on speed, it really made me think on, I think it's the scene from the archetypal pre-crime movie, Minority Report. I think at some point they get a prediction from one of the how do you call it, the prediction people. At some point, a door is kicked in right in time to prevent either a murder or some violent act. Do you think that, despite the limitations that you just sketched, do you think that the crime prediction is becoming more real time, or is there always going to be this lag?
I think there are certain, you know, real world problems that you know, go beyond the scope of algorithms and data. So, I mean, to answer the question straightforward, no, probably not. I think, you know, real-time awareness is something that, as a concept or an idea, has been floated around for quite some time. And if I'm not mistaken, it actually originates in the military, you know, kind of the, you know, real-time situational awareness in military operations. Goes back to the idea of network-centric warfare in the 90s. And I think it might actually be a viable strategy in, you know, dynamic, you know, battle situations or something. But in the actual, you know, real life in a city, there's just, you know, too many variables that factor into the datafication of crime, the analysis, and then the enactment. You can only speed up things to a certain point, and after that, it just doesn't get any faster. And I think, you know, a very pertinent example here is that there's a time lag between the occurrence of a burglary the point in time where the burglary is kind of notified by the residents. They call the police. The police come. The police create data. The data goes into the system. The data needs to be analyzed. A memo needs to be created. All this takes time. But I think what's most pertinent here is that there can be a quite substantial time lag between the occurrence of a burglary and, you know, if I'm away on holiday or a business trip, I only get home, 5 days later or so. I find my apartment broken into. I call the police, and we don't know when the burglary actually happened. It could have been 5 days ago. So, you know, and there's nothing that the police can do about these 5 days. There's a lot of, you know, real world challenges in terms of speeding up that, you know, kind of really escape the means of data and algorithms. So they are not in the power of the police or, you know, any industry company for that matter.
Yeah. Did you come during the whole research process? Did you come across particular success stories of predictive policing?
Anecdotally, yes. I recall one anecdote that a senior officer from one German police department told us, they had been implementing predictive policing in their precinct, large German city, and they had been kind of making mixed experiences, I would say, and they couldn't really tell whether it was working or not, prevention paradox and all. But this was during the summer. When was the migration thing? Was it 2019, 2018? I don't actually recall. In any case, Angela Merkel opted to open the German borders for refugees coming in, and in that city they had a massive influx of people, and so all police resources were kind of, you know, drawn away from whatever they were doing at the time and drawn into the management of refugee movement, basically. So what happened was that in the city where they were running pre-cops, they had to, you know, kind of temporarily do away with all the targeted patrols. And what they immediately saw was an uptick in residential burglary. So they still, you know, they still had the data. They still, you know, came up with the analytics, and they still predicted that burglaries would be happening in certain spaces and certain timeframes, but they didn't have the means to act upon it. And they saw these burglaries actually happening. Now, again, you know, this is anecdotal evidence. It's not systematic. These are the little, you know, success stories that I think also internally with the police, they're kind of used to also convince people internally that what they are doing makes sense, right? Because otherwise, you kind of create that basic conflict where, you know, why should I do what a machine tells me I know better, right? And so I think these stories are also kind of mobilized to tell people that, you know, look, it can make your life easier. It can aid you in your professional tasks. So, you know, you shouldn't be, fully opposed to it, but, you know, you should give it a chance. These kinds of anecdotes were told to us at several occasions. You have to take them with a grain of salt, I guess.
Yeah, figure. So I would like to ask one final question before we go, because it's already been almost an hour. The standard question, you already told me a tiny bit about it right before the show. What is it you are working on right now?
Right now, I'm setting up a new research project on data quality. And this is a direct outcome, of course, from the predictive policing research project. And we spoke about data quality for a bit. there's many more, you know, super interesting aspects to data quality that concern, for instance, you know, classification systems, different databases, how they become consolidated, how they also try to come up with automated ways of checking databases for duplicates or for, you know, false entries, and so on. And so what I'm setting up right now is a larger research agenda that hopefully, depending on funding, of course, will look into data quality issues in European law enforcement and border control databases. So yeah, fingers crossed, that's going to be something that I will pay attention to over the next 3 years or so.
Fascinating. Let's hope that this will become the next book we can talk about.
Yeah, let's hope so.
All right. I want to thank you, Matthias, for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great conversation. Enjoyed it a lot.
All right. See you. Bye-bye.